You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Good to have you along. I'm Bill Radke.
It still makes me tear up every time I remember this. I was lucky to know from a very young age that I was different from other girls and that I was not going to be like my sisters, attracted to boys, but I didn't have the language to describe what I was or who I was.
Jackie Lorenzar grew up in Mexico City in the 80s in a conservative, powerful family. When Jackie was in her early teens, her parents found out she was gay, and they kicked her out. But Jackie was lucky. She had friends who helped her, got her jobs playing in bands.
So one thing led to another, and all of a sudden I met a man, Alejandro Cervantes, who was an artist. He was the first openly gay man to run for office in Mexico City.
Alejandro won that election, but then started to get death threats. A week later, he was found beaten, close to death. That's when Jackie and her friends, other gay and lesbian activists, realized they were in danger too. So Jackie made plans to go into hiding. She's going to tell you her story. I warn you, it gets harrowing about 4 minutes in, hard to listen to, and probably not appropriate for kids. Okay, so Jackie feels she's in danger in Mexico City, and she has what she calls a crazy idea.
So I had this crazy idea of going to say goodbye to my mother. So I went to visit her, and it was in that trip that I didn't know the police were watching the place where we lived. So I got arrested before I got to my parents' house. And I was taken to a place, I still don't know where it was, but I think I was there for about 3 or 4 days, and my father was a member of the government at that time, and he actually told me that the government had a list of my friends, and that if anything happened, he was not going to intervene or do anything because they were bad people. Because, you know, we never got along, so I was like, oh, this is another one of his crazy things. But he was right. I mean, he told me the truth. And I didn't find out until many years later when I applied for asylum. At my interview, the immigration officer actually had a list of all the LGBTQ activists that had been disappeared or murdered during a 3-year period. And I knew all of them.
Did you fear for your life?
Yes. Yes.
So then, when you were in your early 20s, I think this was in the mid-90s, you decided you needed to leave Mexico. You got together some money, headed to the airport, and how did you end up in Seattle?
Well, we asked the person at the airport how far I could go with the money that I had. I had about $300, and she said, Seattle. And I was like, where is that? And she just told me, have you heard of Nirvana? And I was like, oh, yeah.
Nirvana.
Love Nirvana. And she said, like, what, there. And I was, okay, let's go to Seattle. So I ended up here with $20 and my guitar, and that was it. Never look back.
And when you got here, you applied for asylum.
Not right away, because as you can imagine, I was really afraid and traumatized by all the things that have happened. So I really didn't want anybody to know that who I was or how I got here. And so it took about a year for me to gather the courage to tell the attorney, okay, submit my application.
So this would have been a first for someone to come from Mexico and apply for asylum saying, I'm being persecuted for my sexual orientation in my home country.
Yeah.
What was that whole experience like, trying to be that first?
Well, it was nerve-wracking and very scary because I had never told what had happened to me to anybody. And so the person I worked with in my case was amazing because she really helped me to kind of tell the story. I had I had nightmares. I had I later actually was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder because of the torture, and I still to this day deal with the sequels of that. Like I had all sorts of medical issues because of that.
May I ask you how you were tortured? Can you talk about that?
I can talk about, just kind of traumatic, so people who are listening, you know, just beware. Mm-hmm. I got electric shocks on my genitals for 3 days, and I was raped. As a result of that, I had to have a total hysterectomy when I was in my late 20s. They also use, they would put a plastic bag on my head with a chili pepper. And so I had, you know, when I couldn't breathe, I would breathe it in and it will burn and burn my eyes. So my nose will start bleeding and you feel like you're choking. So for many, many years, when I felt stress, I would start feeling that feeling that I couldn't breathe. I would start feeling that I was choking. And I would lose my voice for days because of the my body remembering those feelings. So I couldn't talk. And that was part of the difficulty in telling my story, was that, you know, I would get to that point and I couldn't talk. And she was like, what's happening? What's going on? And I just couldn't say anything else. So I had to wait 3 days, 4 days for me to kind of feel safe again to kind of retell it. But it took a lot for me to really recount everything that happened to me. And I would say it took years for me to be able to get to this point where I can tell the story without just breaking up and start shaking, or like, you know, the poor officer, when he interviewed me, I actually threw up because I was so afraid that, you know, my experience with people with uniforms was not very good. So seeing somebody there asking me all these questions, I threw up. And he was very understanding and compassionate, which helped me to tell him what had happened and how I had got here. But it was very hard. And so after that point, I realized if it was hard for me, that I had, you know, the luck to have an attorney that was very understanding, very knowledgeable, and people who were helping me, it just hit me that for people who don't have that, it must seem impossible. So from that day on, I decided that I wanted to help other people like me to find safety.
Do you remember when you found out that you had been granted asylum?
It's a horrible day in American history. It was September 11, 2001. And I remember watching the news and seeing the towers falling and opening a letter and reading, you have been granted asylum to the United States. And I didn't know if I should cry or be happy, or like, it was a crazy day. Yeah.
That must be amazing, an amazing memory.
It is. Yeah, it is. I remember I have these three friends that are like my brothers, and, you know, they wanted to go out to dinner, and I was like, how can we go out to have dinner and celebrate when this horrible thing happened? And the thing that I was most worried about is the repercussions on immigrants and refugees like me.
So you were in Seattle.
Yeah.
You were working with the LGBT community here, mm-hmm. With the city, with different organizations.
Yeah.
And then something happened just a couple of years ago that you felt that you had prepared your entire life for.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, I got a call from Ann McGettigan, who's the director of an organization called Seattle Counseling Service here in Seattle. They've been providing mental health services for the LGBT community for more than 45 years. They're one of the first organizations to do that in the world. And I felt very grateful to them because when I first arrived here, somebody referred me to them. And it was thanks to them that I was able to get help to deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder and the torture. They actually referred me to a psychiatrist at UW that worked with me for many years. So I always thought one day I'm going to do something for them, but you know, I never had enough money to be a donor. So when she called me and said, hey, we got a grant to start a program for LGBTQ immigrants, refugees, and undocumented, and help them to get mental health services, would you be willing to help us design the program? And I was like, yes, of course. And so I told them, let's ask if we can use the money to do a survey and gather data from people who are here in King County and find out what are their needs and how we can really help. And so this idea of creating a survey was born.
Yeah, but how difficult must it have been to get people, immigrants, LGBTQ members who had been through this experience to talk about it?
It was really hard. And actually, I was telling somebody that I actually failed because my idea was to interview 100 people. And I was able only to interview 52. So
the rest didn't even want to do an interview.
No, and it was, I think it's to this day, one of the hardest things that I've ever done because it made me realize, one, how safe I felt now, like after all this time, that I was in a very different place. But also made me realize that things hadn't changed that much in other parts of the world. And I was sitting with people that had come from Africa, from the Arab countries, telling me the same things that I had gone through. And I was sitting there going, wow, here I am, you know, thinking these folks are just going to come and tell me when I couldn't do that. So we redesigned the whole process of the survey to address confidentiality in a very, very special way. Because a lot of the folks that I interviewed in the beginning, five of them told me that it was crucial that nobody could identify them or their families back home. Because for a lot of their families being related to somebody in the LGBT community could mean death or life in prison. So they asked me to remove any kind of identification, name, phone numbers. So what we did was we actually created a survey in a laptop that was only used for that. And it was amazing. Once we did that, one person referred me to another person and that person to another person. And the one thing that really struck me was the hope that we all had. Like, even though we had been through horrible things, we had this hope that now we had a chance at life. And that was amazing.
I'm amazed that these people even could tell you a story like that and put words to their experiences.
And, you know, I think part of it is that I could relate to them, and that in a way they could see it and feel it. That I was not somebody that was just asking these questions out of curiosity or morbosity, but that I really cared.
So you talked about the fear. Was that what else was the biggest challenge in collecting this data, these human stories?
Well, the other big challenge was, and this was another realization that I had while talking to people, is that in a lot of our countries, the language doesn't have the words to describe who we are. And in the United States, we've been having for the last 15 years this conversation about gender equity, gender expression, sexual orientation, sexual preference, and the whole continuum within that. That has not happened in a lot of other countries. And so people here had a have words to describe their experience in loving relationships and sexual attractions or how they express their gender, that in other countries or other cultures is not the case. Like I learned, for example, that in Arabic, there is no word for gay. And there are some insults that refer to gay people or transgender people, but they wouldn't use them because they're offensive. So how then do you describe your experience? How do you talk about the feelings that you have, either or the attractions that you have, in a way that you don't get lost in that world of hate and reinforce all that those hate images that you've been growing up with since you were a child? So I had all these conversations with them, and we created a glossary of terms of words that are used here in the United States. And we will talk about them first and just say, so these are some of the things that are used here to describe this, 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 and that. But you can define yourself whatever way you want to. But this is just a point of reference. And that helped a lot. And still there were people that had a lot of difficulty relating because, for example, in Africa, this man from Uganda told me that to say I'm a gay man had a connotation that he would align politically with American politics and an American agenda. And that was not him. So he said, I love men, but I am not gay.
Wow. To not even have words for yourself that aren't soaked in hate or partisanship, that's profound.
It is. It is. And that's what made me realize how important it is to have mental health services for folks, because you need somebody that is trained on this therapeutic processes to really help you unfold all of that and really find that piece of you that's still pure, where you can find love for yourself, where you can find acceptance, and then just, you know, rebuild yourself and go out and find happiness.
So you had that realization.
Yeah.
You'd gathered these stories, and now how's that information being used?
Well, Seattle Counseling actually uses the information to create a program. So today they have it's called the Immigrant Refugee Outreach Project, and they offer counseling services and mental health services to any LGBTQ members in those populations. And because of the way healthcare works right now, people who are not insured are able to get services through a special, they created a way in which folks who have no access to any other type of insurance can get care. And it's a small program, but it's the first that there is. And that's amazing. I talk to people all over the world, from China to Iran, that are looking at how they can duplicate some of the stuff that we did so they can reach those populations in their countries. And I don't work for them anymore, but I'm still talking to organizations that work with immigrant and refugee populations or work with the LGBT community and want to do a better job at serving both. That's a big shift in just a year from when we did the survey to now. So,
what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is to see people that, you know, in the face of all of this, they don't give up. One of the things that I've learned through all of this is that if we really want to see services for our community, we need to start working to make those things happen. And so we need to do the research, we need to gather the data, we need to tell our stories, and we need to be courageous and say, I'm here, and I matter, and I'm going to work to make my life worth something, right? Because we only have one life, and if we don't use it to make the world better, then, you know, I don't know why we're here for.
Jackie Lorenzar, I'm really glad you came in and told us your incredible story. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just want to say, you know, my story is one of thousands. And there are many, many others that might not have the opportunity or are not there in a place where they're able to tell it. But to them, I just want to tell them that they need to tell their story because our stories matter. And they're part of a history that needs to be told.
I want to thank Jackie Lorenzar, who's now an election supervisor for King County Elections. She has worked as the LGBTQ immigrant and refugee outreach specialist for the Seattle Counseling Service, where she ran a survey of Seattle LGBTQ refugees and immigrants.